Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Not even a life-altering explosion can stop a hero during difficult times. Attend the opening ceremony at Firehouse World in February 2011 to hear Marine Corporal Joshua Blyle share about a bombing in Iraq that took both his legs. You'll leave motivated to face whatever challenges may come your way when you're out on your next call. Get complete details at firehouseworld.com.
You are listening to Training and Tactics Talk on firehouse.com. Training and Tactics Talk is a monthly podcast featuring the fire service leaders, instructors from all across the United States and the world even, talking about real tactical operations from a street-level perspective. And we're going to be focusing on the cutting-edge training for this modern-day fire service that we live in. The focus of Training and Tactics Talk is to provide you, the firefighter or the fire officer, that information that is critical that you need to make decisions and to make your job as a firefighter safer and more effective and efficient through being able to address key issues that are out there that are facing the fire service today. The mission of Training and Tactics Talk is to help develop those predicated skills, that knowledge, those abilities to ensure that everyone goes home. We want to thank you for tuning in. I'm your host, Douglas Klein, and joining me today is Ryan Pennington. And Ryan, most of y'all have probably read some of his articles on firehouse.com. He's a firefighter paramedic with the City of Charleston Fire Department in Charleston, West Virginia, the capital city. He is currently assigned to Station 8, and he has about 15 years of combined fire rescue EMS experience. He's a member of the West Virginia Regional Response Team Task Force 1. He's a West Virginia State Fire Instructor Level 2, is involved heavily across the state and now across the nation with EMS and firefighter safety instruction. In fact, he'll be in Delaware this month talking to the Delaware Chiefs. So it's great to have Ryan on board, and thank you for being a contributor to firehouse.com and maintaining a blog. And that blog is Views from the Jump Street, or the Jump Seat rather, at blogspot.com. So Ryan, welcome on board. We're super happy to have you. And anything else you want to bring to the table with us about what's going on in the world of firefighting and instructing for you?
Oh, thanks a lot, Chief. Thanks for inviting me on the podcast today. I think you pretty much covered it all. Trying to stay warm and the snow keeps coming.
Well, you know, that happens, especially in the northern part of the United States currently. Some of our places are getting pounded and expecting more. Fire operations do change as we talk about tactics and our operations when the seasons do change. And, of course, that's important. And to our listeners, we want to invite you, if you've got a question, you can email us at podcast@firehouse.com. So right now, I'll tell you what, let's grab us a cup of coffee or that cold drink, pull you up a chair or a seat on the tailboard, and let's enjoy what we have in front of us. So kick back, relax, and enjoy, and let's get started. And let's talk about a topic called searching in the modern environment. Now, we know, if you've been around any length of time, that the environment has changed. I can remember coming in the very early 80s, and in fact in 1980, and we weren't even wearing air packs at the time. In fact, you know, that was, you know, the time period when a lot of that transition began to occur. I can remember actually being taught, you know, to search, you know, on fires even without an air pack. But, you know, when I first came in, it was becoming that transition of utilizing an air pack because the environment had changed. And that environment had changed significantly, and we see it change even more. And let's just throw a statistic out here, Ryan, to everybody. Between 1980 and 1989, when in that time period, that was the critical beginning foundation years, as they call it, for a firefighter. In that time period, there were 44 firefighters that lost their lives as a result of rapid fire phenomenon. And this was a huge study that went on, and it was this modern environment that we're in today, and it continues to evolve. So what's your thoughts about what you've seen over the last 15 years versus, you know, close to my 30 now? How much has really changed when you go in and you begin operations in the environment that you're at, especially when it comes down to searching?
I started my fire service career in the volunteer organization in 1994, and I can't tell you, just as you were reflecting back on your past, how much the environment has changed. In my experiences, today's environment over the past 15 years, it seems like there's a plethora of changes. One of the very first changes I've noticed is the amount of belongings, stuff, furniture that we're crawling through is just the actual amounts of it that these people are putting in their houses. I don't really want to use the word hoarders, but we can cover that as well. But even as I look around my living room, I've got a sectional sofa, I've got a big lazy boy, I've got a big screen TV, and it just seems like you have to change your tactics on it. I was taught in 94 we do a right-hand search or a left-hand search, and boy, it sure does make it hard nowadays to do that type of a search where you run into a six-piece sectional sofa or a 52-inch big screen television. I mean, you really lose contact with the wall. So it seems like in my experience, to change those tactics, for one thing, that tactic does, it's a great way to doing things. It keeps you oriented to where you're at, so that way you don't get lost. But it sure does take a whole lot of time. We're experiencing rapidly developing fires that grow so much faster, exponentially over minutes of time. So how long do you really have to get in here and search these houses? So what I'm finding, my experience, is to go to more like an oriented search. Have your two-person crew, instead of using the right or left-hand search, stay at the doorway, not wandering more than 12 or 14 feet away from it. One person staying oriented to where they're at while the other one searches the room. It seems like you're able to cover a whole lot more ground, a whole lot faster and safer. Just getting around these obstacles has just been just hard as you can be, because it seems like it's just so much more stuff involved in it.
Well, you're bringing out some good points about how difficult the actual operation is, and you've alluded to a couple of things that definitely sticks out. The fire load in residential structure specifically is measured in foot per pound. So when you're looking at the area or square footage area that you have, there's so many pounds in that area. And it has more than doubled in the last 50 years. Now, looking at more than doubling, you think about in the last 50 years, that's a lot. Now, you look at what happens. The quantity of heat that's being produced, it's exceeding those of ordinary combustibles. And we all know the reason why. It's solidified petroleum products. Therefore, when it burns, you know, really fast. It also has lower ignition temperatures. The smoke that's produced off of it is extremely toxic. Flashovers, you know, that heat level, that's our killer there. That's the things that have those significant events, is flashovers are beginning to occur in a more common lower temperature range. So we got to look at that. So, you know, when I started or back, you know, if we start comparing, you know, from, you know, 30, 40 years ago, we have these tests out there, and you can see those on the web, and UL and NIST, and those folks are really doing a great job at studying this and providing information out. But the fire progression is a key, and we see that with it. So let's talk a little bit now. You were talking about moving around in this environment, and I know back from, you know, being involved in operations over the years, especially when assigned to actually doing searches and working in this, that it becomes very difficult. Even with the tools that we're giving folks today, with thermal imaging cameras and that, still becomes difficult. So let's pick a point here and let's start and let's progress through this a little bit. Just how bad is it when you go in on visibility today versus what it was 15 years ago?
I think the visibility is exponentially 10 times, 100 times worse, because it seems like with an ordinary combustible fire, you're looking at the just the thickness and density of the smoke itself. It seems like it's went from a light gray to a dark gray to a progressive, just a pitch black environment. I can recall crawling out of many fires and taking my hand and trying to wipe my mask off, and that stuff don't come off anymore. So it just makes your vision just so bad. And then the thermal imaging camera. What good is a thermal imaging camera when you can't even see the screen? I mean, you can get in some of these fires. Take a couch, for instance. What kind of smoke comes off of a couch or any of your petroleum-based products? It makes it so thick and so dense you can't even see your thermal imaging camera. So it almost can render them useless.
And you were talking about your face piece there. And, you know, if those deposits are falling on your face piece or they're adhering to it, they're also adhering to the screen, which obscures your vision. But here's another piece that I've run across, especially once you engage in fire suppression tactics, is I can remember crawling in the basement of a fraternity fire, and we were the second crew down. A good friend of mine, who's a battalion chief now, Barry McLam, was down in the basement, and he was a captain at the time as well. We were down in the basement. We were working, and we had thermal imagers. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't see. I was using my camera. It was pretty much just a white screen. It wasn't super hot. Everything was pretty much getting to the one temperature level where, you know, we had steamed it so bad down there. And I asked the question to him. I said, "Can you see anything?" He said, "No." I said, "Do you have your camera with you?" And he says, "I do." And, of course, you know, at the time, those were about $22,000 a piece. And, you know, we still couldn't operate. And you're exactly right. We're having some difficulties in there. But let's stop and think about it. Let's shift gears now and move to the next little piece here and talk about risk-benefit analysis. If that type of atmosphere exists,
is the patient more alive?
Yeah, how many patients are alive? It's lethally, you know, it's just deadly. The amount of lethal levels of gases and byproducts that are in there make it non-conducive to people being able to survive. We've got to take a look at this and seeing what's there. So a lot of it is, are we going to risk our people being in there to the degree that we're not going to save anything? Now, let me stop and say this. You, as well as I, are hardcore firefighters. We're going to go and we're going to do our best to save anybody and everybody, and that's just the tradition of the fire service. We're raised that way. We're born that way. We're inbred that way as far as our training. It's instilled from day one that the number one priority is life safety, and ours being, you know, first, of course. But we're seeing more and more over the years that the potential for really successful rescues are declining if you're not there very, very quickly and actually have them in what is known as a pocketed area. What are you seeing in Charleston? I know that y'all have run a lot. I know you've had some successful events that have occurred there and some that weren't so successful. So let's kind of, you know, breeze by those a little bit and talk about them.
We've had a couple recent events here in our department, some successful and some not. I can't agree with you more as far as the survivability of these patients or victims, whatever you want to call them, in these environments. It seems like the chances of survival are so limited. I tell you what we have run into here in our area is people talking on cell phones. When they call 911, they'll stay on their cellular telephone or whatever and say, "Hey, I'm trapped. I'm trapped in the second floor. I'm in the back bedroom. I can't get out. It's filling up full of smoke." So it almost gives you like a real-time analysis of how your patient's doing. "Hey, guys, it's been 5 minutes. I still have them on the telephone. I can hear them struggling to breathe. The dispatcher's telling them what to do. I'm telling them to get down there, cover the doorways." And it's almost scary to think that you can almost hear this person dying on the telephone. But what that means to us is it gets you fired up, and it might put us in a situation where we might not need to be. I mean, this patient might not be salvageable. Just like you said, it's the risk versus reward. It just needs to be evaluated not only by company officers, but even a street-level firefighters. it can just put us in situations we shouldn't be, because we are. We're the brave. We're the firefighters. We're here to save you. So I really think that's a decision all of us should be making.
Well, absolutely, and that's something that really plays into that. And part of what you're finding is if you're getting this information, and that information is readily available for you, it allows you to do a lot more tactics and gives you some other opportunities to embark on ways of doing rescue. A lot of times we get hung up on this. We got to go through the front door, and we got to search and find them. You just gave a good example of when a vent enter search is just, you know, the best case scenario. You have a real close general proximity. You know that they have, in this case, a potential of a good external window. If you've got access to that window, or you can get access to that window very quickly, you can ventilate it. That immediately increases their chance of survivability.
Sure.
It also changes the dynamics that are in there for the safety of the firefighter, which allows you to go in and get them out. Part of what we don't want to do is, you know, delay them getting to, quote-unquote, fresh air by having to drag them all the way through the house. We want to get them out as quickly as possible. And here's the case. We've got one of the most predominant fire gases that's really showing up is CO. And we know that it's going to require going to a hyperbaric chamber to try to off-gas this, you know, through decompression. The other piece that we have is hydrogen cyanide. Now, you're a paramedic.
Yes, sir.
Are you carrying hydrogen cyanide antidote kits on your rig?
No.
Okay. So right there, you've got a delay. Even when you get them out, trying to get them to the hospital, you get them there. Now, I know you're working into a major trauma center for the state.
Mm-hmm.
They're most likely going to have that right in the ER. But for our listeners who are out in rural America going into smaller ERs, they may be required to have to go to the pharmacy to get it, you know, which is even more of a delay. So, you know, we've got a time frame. And of course, hydrogen cyanide is a cellular affixant. It attacks you at, you know, your cellular level. It blocks the use of oxygen to make energy. And, you know, for all the paramedic folks, it causes this acid-base balance shift and sends you into metabolic acidosis, even though it's respiratory-related. So we've got some pieces there that fit in. So vent enter search. On these particular cases, did you see anything that worked better? Were there some techniques that you can say were, you know, efficient and effective that you would like to share with our listeners?
A couple challenges they faced in one particular case was a large window air conditioning unit, and it was actually bolted in. And after reviewing an after incident analysis of removing that unit, it was very difficult. It was a stone house, so they couldn't cut the window members. So they kind of reviewed using the circular saw to cut the braces and get them out a whole lot faster. Some of the challenges, to go back to your question before, in this house was just the amount of debris in this one. This one actually happened to be a hoarder-type environment, to whereas they had the interior stairwells, the interior entryway, and the hallways was so full of dare I say, junk or their belongings. It just made passage by the firefighters impossible. Another challenge they faced was an interior lift chair. This patient was handicapped. He couldn't walk. He was pretty much wheelchair-bound and used an access power chair, if you have, to go up the stairwells, which made it almost impossible for two firefighters to even access the upper room. So those challenges just proved to be, you take one of them, it's easy to deal with. If you take two or three of them and compound them together, it makes for a very tough extrication of that patient.
Absolutely. And how many places across the United States or the world do we have those same challenges? They're not just unique to your area. They're, you know, pretty common, and people have to recognize that. Let's talk a little bit here about some misconceptions that are out there. You know, one of the things that I see is that, and it becomes really an issue, is that people make the mistake of going beyond the point of no return in the search for victims. And, in other words, they get in so deep, they start using their bottles, and typically we know when, quote-unquote, the bell goes off is when everybody's going to start heading towards the door.
Yeah, and we just can't let that happen.
Exactly, because in some of the houses, and we got to stop and think about this, this modern environment, you know, when we first got into this business, especially when I did, you know, a huge house was 2,000, 2,500 square feet. It's nothing now to have a 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 square foot house that you may be charged fully with smoke that you're operating in.
Mm-hmm.
So it changes that misconception. You can't just pop yourself right back out. Some of these areas have, you know, rooms, you know, in the core that don't have windows. So you can't just go to a window. So there's a lot of thought process here people have to get into. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, Chief. It seems like, just, I hate to interrupt here, but on that point, it seems like with the engineered wood beams, we're seeing more of a span in that area as well, where the traditional stick built like I have in my house, it seems like they can go 10, 12, 14, 16 feet. But with these engineered wood beams, you're talking spaces of anywhere from 18 to 20, 22-foot openings.
Exactly. And, you know, at this point in time, you're almost getting into a mass area, which changes things to a degree. I mean, people don't think about a mass area in mm-hmm. a single-family residential structure, but reality is I've been in houses that have been there. You know, I've been in houses that have been 13, 14,000 square feet.
Sure. So, all of us have them in our area.
Oh, yeah. It's something that truly sticks out there, so we got to think. One of the things that occurred... this was back in the 90s. Everybody went from the shift from a 30-minute SCBA bottle to a 45-minute SCBA bottle. Now, there was a lot of controversy on whether that was good or whether that was bad. You know, it allows you to do things. The only issue that I see with it is, what are the condition of your people? In other words, their physical condition, their abilities to perform that extra time period. And also, is that extra time period giving them a little more time to get deeper than what they should?
Yeah.
Bottom line, in this is a precursor of a statement. The only piece of equipment that can truly save us is our brains and the knowledge that's in it and the use of it and the application of it and doing the right things.
And that goes from everybody on the fire ground. When I write my blog, I try to write it from the back seat. I don't make really a whole lot of tactical decisions. I pretty much get told what to do. But does that mean I'm not responsible for my safety? No, it's not. And I really do believe that everybody needs to take responsibility for their actions. Even though I'm a part of a member, I might not be the leader. I can add my opinions or my observations, especially if I'm doing a vent enter search where I'm going to find somebody. Take time to notice the windows. Take time to notice an interior stairwell. You got to be prepared if things go wrong, because it does go wrong daily. We are updated daily on things that have gone wrong. And these guys are doing things right. They're fully addressed. They're fully equipped. They're fully staffed, and things still continue to go wrong. So I really think the term situational awareness gets overused, but I really think it hits the nail on the head in this situation. Sure, we're going in, we're removing victims, but we need to be aware of our surroundings at all times. Be prepared for when the proverbial poop hits the fan. We need to get out. We need to get out fast. We don't want to rely on that Mayday or that RIT crew to come get us, because that just puts them in harm's way as well.
You're absolutely right. I heard a phrase the other day. Somebody said RIT is not it anymore. Well, we have to have that. When things go wrong, you've got to have the backup crew.
Sure.
But what I think people are doing is they're putting too much emphasis on two people that they're calling RIT standing in the front yard being the end-all, cure-all. There's a lot more to that, and you're bringing some good points out. Currently, we're up to a break time, so what we need to do is stop here. When we come back, we're going to continue talking about this. We're going to add some dimension to it. We're going to talk about some commercial responses, some issues that we're facing in other areas when it comes down to our searching, especially when it comes down to staffing that you brought up, Ryan. So to our listeners, you're listening to Training and Tactics Talk, real issues, real training, and real solutions, focusing on our number one priority with everyone going home, and we'll be back right after this.
Firehouse World 2011 is the largest fire service event west of the Mississippi and takes place in San Diego, California, February 26th through March 2nd. Register today at firehouseworld.com and be part of the action. You will have access to over 100 training and educational sessions, 350 exhibitors, plus network with over 7,500 firefighters from around the country. This is one event you don't want to miss.
Well, welcome back to Training and Tactics Talk. I'm your host, Douglas Klein, and joining me today from the capital city of West Virginia and the Charleston Fire Department is Ryan Pennington, who is a firefighter paramedic. Ryan, we were talking before we took the break about actually being engaged in some search operations and really finding the nuances that fit to what's going on today. In other words, this modern environment. I know that in the not-so-distant past, you actually had a save, a grab, and it was pretty unique in some of the things that we've had discussion about with this particular case. So I want you to share it with our listeners and give some of the issues that you ran into, and we're going to talk a little bit about how that affects our searching. So why don't you tell us about your grab?
Sure. It's before I transferred to the capital city. I belonged for 3 years to a smaller department here in the suburbs, the Nitro Fire Department. Our typical staffing level is three men, and we usually run a one-engine response in our first due. We had a reported structure fire. We didn't find out that we had confirmed entrapment until we arrived. Heavy fire conditions, and we did a vent inner search from a side window. Confirmed entrapment, knew the victim's location, and as we entered the fire room, and he was actually in the fire room, standing up, unprotected, no clothes on. I would consider him really burnt that bad, but I would attribute it to what you're talking about earlier was the carbon monoxide poisoning. He was semi-conscious, groaning, and we actually had to wrestle him and take him to the ground before we could even drag him out. And then we ran into another situation. Once again, this was another cluttered environment. He was not clothed. He was halfway burnt. He was sort of wet because the second new engine crew was starting to attack the fire. And here we have this 260-pound man to drag through this stuff. It really, really taxed a two-man crew to our limits to the point where we got within 10 or 15 feet of, we actually ended up bringing him out a doorway. We actually had to call for more manpower because after we made access to the room, found the victim, wrestled him to the ground, and then drug him approximately 10 to 20 feet, we were spent. We were absolutely done.
Well, that brings up a pretty unique point, and it's, you know, common across the United States, and it's become even more commonplace that the staffing levels are even smaller, probably smaller than they've been in many, many a year. That affects things. It changes how you've got to do operations. It changes how you engage. But you just brought out a piece that's just imperative that people understand, is that two people trying to remove a normal size adult is nothing more than just hardcore physical labor. A lot of times it takes a second crew to get that group out. You know, I can think of a particular grab that we had one time. I was on an apartment complex. We went in, and the smoke was moderate smoke. It wasn't too awful bad. In fact, the individual could have probably gotten up and walked out the front door. They were elderly. I think the carbon monoxide did play into this one. They went to the bed and laid down.
Yeah.
And we arrived, and I was, you know, with another individual. As we went in the room, I went grabbing the shoulders, and he grabbed the feet. And the lady looked up and says, "It's the angels." And I said, "No, ma'am, we're just the fire department, but we're here to help." But, you know, this carbon monoxide or the anoxia that occurs from the lack of oxygen to the brain creates issues. Again, you had to fight and wrestle this guy, and that's not uncommon with victims that are disoriented in the smoke and are exposed to these high levels of carbon monoxide. They could become extremely combative. We know this because that was part of the case with Brett Tarver out in Phoenix, mm-hmm. is that they were physically engaging with, you know, this brawn firefighter that had carbon monoxide on board and was very violent and very physical, and the same thing that you ran into. So that's stuff that people have got to think about a little bit, you know, always in the back of the mind, you know, what are we going to run into? And always knowing that if you're even on your staffing. In other words, if you don't have people in staging, you're behind.
Yeah.
That's something that you need to be thinking about. And when you're engaging in these, and I know most times it's the first due assignment that's rolling in there, and our best case scenario is getting the first or second due company in and getting these folks out if we're going to save them. So you necessarily are not going to have a ton of staffing that's going to be there to back you up. And if you go into rural America, you may not have anybody for a long period of time.
No, it seems like that first due engine is the one that's usually making these rescues. It's not that big rescue truck or even the first due truck company. It always seems like it's the first due engine that's making these rescues.
And that's common. And if you think about it, we go to rural America, there's not great big ladder trucks and great big rescue trucks and, you know, lots of people rolling in. Its reality is a lot of times if you got six people on a fire scene, you're doing good.
I mean, that's reality.
So think about that.
It really is. I mean, here in West Virginia, I'm very fortunate to be in the capital city of a 50,000 strong. We've got 9 engines, 2 trucks, 2 rescues. It's great. But here where I live at and volunteer at the Tyler Mountain Volunteer Fire Department, if you get 3 people, you're on a good day. And I really think, especially when you hear the words entrapment, my gosh, get on the radio, call your automatic, call your mutual, call in the Coast Guard if you have to. But you know what? It's imperative for our safety that we've got more people coming.
You're right. I couldn't agree with you more. And that's just America's fire service. You know, even though we're running into some problems now with the decreased amount of staffing, especially in municipalities or paid departments where they're decreasing and depending on mutual aid, we're even seeing it now where some of the mutual aids are not responding because they're always responding over there, and the reciprocating factor is not coming back to them. So this has become an issue.
Yeah, so, very much so.
We got a lot to deal with. But let's shift gears a little bit here. We've been talking residential, we've been talking residential, we've been talking residential. Guess what else we got to deal with?
Commercial.
We got to deal with commercial structures. You're exactly right. Chief Les Stevens from out in Texas, he worked on a great EFO project for the National Fire Academy. And I can remember sitting in the Odd House talking with Les and you know, discussing some of the pieces, and he actually put together a lot of information about go, no-go on commercial structures. One of the pieces that he was looking at is the size. You know, these buildings that we're going to, you know, a lot of times are 6, 7, 8, 10, however many thousands of feet.
Mm-hmm.
I know there's facilities that have millions of square feet that you got to engage into. What I found is that most of our firefighters have only truly been trained on residential search tactics. We rarely engage them on commercial structures, and that's when we're going to get them in trouble. That's when we're going to get them in deep. So there's a lot that we got to think about there as well. So, you know, it's something that I want people to engage their thought process in is, how is it different for a commercial structure? So let's look at you. You're protecting the capital city. There's mid-rise structures that are there. There's large buildings. There's industrial facilities in your district. There's a lot to work with. Talk about some of the issues that y'all are running into and how you're overcoming those.
Well, first thing that comes to my mind immediately, the decisions that I don't make that the actual commanders have to make, is the addition of more crews. Our standard response is 3 engines, 2 trucks, a rescue truck, an ambulance, a battalion chief, and an EMS supervisor. Immediately, just almost immediately, our shift commanders are adding at least a plus one, an engine or an additional 2 engines. These commercial structures, I don't know who coined the phrase horizontal high-rise. I think that is just an accurate description of them. And the thing about it is you're really going to have to fall back before you go into searching these buildings is, are you pre-planning these structures? Do you have a clue what's even in there? Charleston used to be known as the chemical valley or the chemical capital of the world. So we could be crawling into anything from hydrogen cyanide to ethylene oxide to anything. Just the sheer size of them, crew separation, what's the building construction come back to? But as far as key points of searching, crew integrity is paramount in my mind. I mean, if I'm not with my partner or my crew what good am I doing to anybody? Because if I get separated, then I'm a liability. So I would think that we need to concentrate on searching teamwork on top of anything else when it comes to buildings of this size.
Well, absolutely. And one of the things that we've got to have folks that are engaged in is the thought process of how you actually work in these buildings to a quote-unquote nth degree of focusing and being, engaged. Now, searching in a residential structure, a lot of times we will go without any type of contact other than a left-hand or a right-hand search.
Sure.
As we move up into these bigger buildings, and one that comes to mind, or a perfect example that comes to mind, are apartment complexes or hotels that have like center hall corridors that you can work off of having that oriented search.
Sure.
Same thing with vent inner search. But when you hit in some of these bigger areas and mass areas, you definitely have got to have a search rope or a hose line or something that's going to keep you oriented. Because you can get into these, and I know that I've watched people engaged in some training exercises. I've even done it and got just a little bit off, and guess what? You're lost. Whether you want to admit it or not, you're truly lost. You're compromised at that point in time, and getting out is going to be difficult.
In a residential structure, if you run into a couch and a television, where most likely are you at? You're in the living room. If you run into a mattress, you're in a bedroom. Okay, so now let's crawl into a 100 by 150 and you run into an office. Are you really in the office? Are you in some sort of a manufacturing area? You just don't know.
And you're correct on that, and that's part of the issue. And if you don't have good visibility, and the thing about it is we do have a tool that works very well, which is the thermal imaging.
Sure.
That is tremendous for us. It's given us a lot, even though there are limitations. It's just like any tool in the toolbox. It sits there. There's another tool that a lot of people, there's mixed reviews on it. It's called the Target Exit Device. Some folks love them. Some folks say, oh, that's the worst thing under the sun. Well, I'm not going to judge the product. That's not our job here, but we're training in tactics. We're trying to talk about the things that help you. With a Target Exit, I know before this device actually became, available or out, we were utilizing, if somebody was lost or disoriented in a building or you were trying to give them a Target Exit, it was nothing for us to take a strobe. And when we laddered the window, as a truck company, we'd take, a piece of webbing and the strobe and drop it over to the floor.
Sure.
So that they could see it. That gave that target or that flash. If people were disoriented, we've actually utilized a pass device because at the time they were portable pass devices and you just clicked it over into a window and that gave them that target to come to. Well, the Target Exit Device has kind of done both of those combined. They put a strobe and they put this intermittent, tone on there, which allows for communications, and that's critical. And it does help keep you oriented to the structure. Now, I've actually used one of these. We have them at High Point. I have them in Ruffin. I personally like the tool because it gives you an added advantage. And, again, it's nothing more than a tool. That's all it is.
Sure.
In some cases, you can't use it because it's so loud that you can't tell where it's coming from. If you get deep into a building or you have a lot of twists and turns, like in commercial structures, one is not going to work. You have to put these in a parallel series. You have to understand that, and then that becomes even more complicated. So there's a lot of issues that go with these types of devices, but it's also a tool. And I wanted to throw it out there because you mentioned the Target Exit Device, and a lot of people go, what? They've never heard of it. So, trying to, get the tools, get the technology that's out there, that's important. Another advantage that we have in searching today, and it's becoming more and more prevalent, and hopefully we'll have some products out on the market. I know some things are being researched and developed at MIFRI right now, but you can actually track a firefighter on a outline or the pre-entry of a building, and you can see when they're going room to room. You actually know where they're at. So that helps you, get people where they need to be.
That brings up another great point, Chief. I hate to interrupt you right there, but it seems like when we're teaching our aggressive search tactics classes here in West Virginia, is that is something that's really often overlooked, and I really think it could really make the difference in a commercial structure, is how is your communication with your search going? Search team one to command. We've searched the A, B, C quadrant or whatever quadrant. We haven't found anybody. We're proceeding to X, Y, Z coordinates. How often are you giving these updates? Only person we're really protecting is ourselves at this point, because if something goes wrong, they know where we're at. But it also can give that incident commander a view of, hey, they've searched three-quarters of the building and haven't found anything yet. Maybe it's time to do something different.
Well, you're exactly right. Another piece that plays into that when you're talking about communications back and forth, as everybody is, you know, transitioning to the 800 megahertz or 900 megahertz radio.
Sure.
A lot of times these radios don't communicate well outside of a building because of just the structure itself. You know, I know we're fortunate in High Point to actually have some mobile repeaters. And I've watched other departments across the United States that have these, and they'll actually go inside the door and drop a repeater down so it'll pick up the radio signal and shoot it out.
What a great idea.
Oh, man, it's awesome. And that, and right there is the safety piece. When you're searching and you're trying to keep up with what's going on and you're trying to, you know, diligently find somebody and there's changing conditions, communications between everyone that's working, especially that operations officer that's truly engaged in watching what's going on tactically, not necessarily from a command perspective, but tactically, you know, they've got to know, and that's that communication is just, you know, critical that we have it. So that's another tool.
The thing about it is ultimately we're going to have to put the fire out at the same time. And communication is a two-way street in the aspect of, hey, Chief, I'm back here at the BC corner. We haven't found anybody. Attack Team 1 or Search Team 1, you're coming out. Fire conditions have worsened. The fire ground is a dynamic. I mean, it's ever-changing. Either you're making progress, you're not making progress. And you've got to be aware, both inside and out.
Well, you're right. That kind of brings me to the final point we probably need to talk about a little bit. The last show had some phenomenal folks on. Had Chris Nahm and Dave Dotson and Rick from out in Kansas and Pat Wilson from down in Georgia talking about tactical renaissance. What we did at our last fire necessarily is not going to work at this fire. We've really got to truly be students of the business. We have got to engage ourselves deeper into the true understanding of building construction and fire behavior and being able to identify what's going on with the smoke, understanding the unique dynamics that are occurring. I know, and this is part of what I want to talk about, you know, in a serious nature here. We typically, anytime we're engaged in search, the key word is ventilation. I need ventilation.
Sure.
I need ventilation. I need ventilation. You got to be careful today. You ventilate and you don't do the right ventilation, or even if you're just ventilating and putting people in there before certain things have occurred, you create ventilation-induced flashovers.
Sure.
That is very prevalent. It's being studied. There's a lot of work going on that with NIST and UL. They're really looking at this stuff hardcore. But, you know, reality is what we did tactically 10 years ago, 5 years ago, is not going to work today on every single case. It's not a cookie-cutter fire response anymore.
No. No, it really isn't. And basically, what are we crawling through? We're crawling through smoke. What is the definition of smoke? It's the byproducts of incomplete combustion. So what does that mean smoke is? It's combustible. So what is it searching for? It's searching for that one element it's lacking. Is it lacking the heat? Probably not. Is it lacking the fuel? Definitely not. So what's it lacking? It's lacking the oxygen. So if you force that oxygen in an air, you're going to put yourself into a flashover condition. When you're searching, does that mean you're going to put your patients in jeopardy? Of course. Does that mean we're going to put us in jeopardy? Of course. So we need not ventilate. It needs to be a coordinated effort, and that starts with a 360 size up. It starts with the crews trying to figure out what is the trying to figure out a visualization, if you will, in your head. Where is the bedroom? Where is the office? Where is how is this house or business laid out? If we ventilate this front window, are we causing the fire spread to come from a burned part to an unburned part? Right through where the patient's going to be laying at. I could not agree with you more as far as people just going up here popping out windows.
And we've got to even go even farther than that, is it's got to be selective of, you know, your vertical versus horizontal.
Sure.
And especially when we start talking about throwing a positive pressure fan at the door. You know, a lot of departments are really engaged in utilizing positive pressure ventilation, which I'm not against. In fact,
it's got
its place. It's a great tool. But if you go and watch ventinnersearch.com, some of the videos on there, they show you what happens when you put a fan in there very quickly.
And are you doing your patient any good by doing that?
Exactly. So we've got to stop and think about these things. The modern environment is exactly that. It's modern. It's changing.
Mm-hmm.
It changes daily almost. I can, you know, just go back in the time period when I got into the fire service to now. The changes in the environment are phenomenal. And understanding those is paramount. We've got to understand those.
I think we have a real unique advantage in today's fire service that you probably didn't have in the 80s, and I know that I didn't have in the 90s, the Internet. It can be a powerful, powerful learning experience. Just like you said, when you came into the fire service, you probably got set down at the kitchen table and said, all right, firefighter Klein, this is what a backdraft is. This is what a flashover looks like. This is what we do when we've been intersurged. And they told you the stories. This is how we do it. This is what I do it. Boy, nowadays you can take that to a whole different level. I mean, you can Google anything, or you can YouTube anything, and you've taken your experience level of an unexperienced firefighter and giving them some little nuggets. Hey, this is what it's going to look like, or this is the possibilities of what it could look like. I really think that the modern environment in that respect is in our favor.
It is. But the thing about it is you have to look at the product that you're reviewing to make sure it's credible for one.
Sure. Sure.
And secondly, you've got to get people to do it.
Well,
that's the key. You know, you've get, the water is there for the horse to drink. It's the horse has got to drink it. Bottom line, and of course, for training officers, they got to utilize all this technology, because technology is providing us better ways at some things.
Sure.
The ability to pull and utilize everybody else's experiences. What they have is just phenomenal. We've got to engage in that. So let's, looking at the time, we're close. It's about that time for us to do some final wrap-up here. We've covered a lot of material. So what's your final thoughts here, Ryan?
I would encourage all the firefighters out there, and once again, I'm going to take it back to where I am right now. I'm riding in the jump seat on the back of a fire truck, under the control of a directive of an officer, that when it comes to searching in today's modern environment, I think the preparation starts back at the firehouse, maybe even back at the gym. It's a physically demanding, hard task to take care of. You need to choose your weapons accordingly. You need to have your access to your thermal imaging cameras. And I would suggest that they find a tool that they're comfortable with. A lot of people like doing vent inner search with a 6-foot New York hook. A lot of people like doing it with a Halligan bar. I don't care what you choose, whatever you choose, you need to be proficient at it. You need to be good at your job. I really enjoyed your article, Shiners, Whiners, and Recliners. I really can't tell you how much that is. Just hits the nail on the head. Do you want to be a shiner, or do you want to be a whiner recliner? Whether you're paid, volunteer, I don't care. We're all professionals in this business. We owe it to our communities, and we owe it to our families to become professionals at it. If you find that you're not proficient at doing searches, find somewhere to search. This is not high tech that don't need nothing. Pull the fire engines out of your bay, cover up your black mask, tell somebody throw something your way, and let's get searching. Let's get out of the recliners, let's get in the apparatus bays, and let's become good at our job again. Let's be the shiner.
I will take it from the chief's perspective or the officer's perspective, let's say. You've got to know the business. You've got to know the capabilities of your people. You have to understand the environments you're going into. You need to be in these buildings. You need to be engaging. The perfect time to identify issues and structures is when you're there already, whether it's an automatic alarm or whether it's, you know, shortness of breath. You know, you have that ability once you're in there to truly begin that situational awareness component that's building that information about that particular address. And we've got to engage in that more. And from a chief's perspective, you've got to know what's going on when you're standing in that operations role or when you're making the shots from that right jump seat. From the officer perspective, or when you're riding in that command vehicle and saying, hey, this is what we're going to do. You've got to know, and you've got to know what your people are capable of doing. So that's a thought from the officer side.
I completely agree, Chief. The guys playing in the Super Bowl here in a couple weeks, do you think that was the first time they've ever went in a football field? No. They spent their whole lives preparing for one game. Difference between them and us, they know when their game's going to be. Do you know when your next game's going to be? I don't.
Well, I have two good friends, Ray Smith and John White from right here in North Carolina, and they actually do the analogy of truly looking at the fire service from a football perspective. Ray's a big football fanatic, and John is just as hardcore firefighter as you can get, and they go back and forth talking about the prep work. Just
sure.
The same exact same things we were talking about here. So to our folks out there, you've got to train. Don't train until you get it right. Train till you can't get it wrong, and that's important. We've got to be proficient, and Ryan, you hit that on the head. We've got to know our jobs, and we've got to be good at it. We're at the end of the show. And you've been listening to Training and Tactics Talk. And I want to thank Ryan Pennington for coming on board from the City of Charleston Fire Department in West Virginia. It's an honor and a privilege to have you, you know, on the show. You're doing a lot of good work. For our listeners, you can look at some of these articles on firehouse.com. For the folks in Delaware, you're about to have a tremendous, tremendous speaker come in and talk about real-life firefighting to you. So I know that they're excited about that, and I know you are too as well, Ryan. So with Training and Tactics Talk, our guests and this show, there's efforts that are tremendously going to impact the fire service if people will just take an opportunity and begin learning. Our job is to provoke that thought process to begin learning. Training and Tactics Talk is dedicated to providing that cutting-edge training and tactics and the concepts that provide our fire service that necessary knowledge and the tools to be effective, efficient, and safe. And we want to focus every effort on everyone going home. We look forward to having you in a power-packed 2011 year. Some of our future programs are going to be focusing on developing quality training programs. There's going to be more throughout this year on the tactical renaissance and fire combat rules of engagements that are new. We're going to continue going back to the basics, street-level training, and the tactics for today. You know, I'm your host, Douglas Klein. It's a pleasure and a privilege to be involved with Firehouse.com and Training and Tactics Talk, and we hope that we have the opportunity to see you on a future Training and Tactics Talk program. Till next time. Train hard, train often, and stay safe.
The best way to learn a new skill or improve upon one you already have is to actually put it into practice. Choose from 6 hands-on training classes at Firehouse World 2011 in San Diego this coming February. Classes include trench rescue, firefighter survival, air management, extrication, and more. Learn by doing. Complete details available at firehouseworld.com.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.